Somebody was just put out the bar called Beit Chabad. All right, now, they showed me, I want to read you, I think it's very important that we should be aware of these things, because these are, you know, messages that the ordinary Jews read, and the average person would think that they represent the true idea of Judaism. I think it's important when you read something that is problematical and questionable. In my opinion, this is much more serious. I want to get your opinion, then I'll analyze it, and I want to show, you know, what I'm basing myself on in terms of the proper sources, because I think it deals with something which is extremely important. Now, this is put out by Chabad, which is Lubavitch, and it says a weekly newsletter inspired by the talks of the Lubavitch Rebbe. I'm not getting into anything like that, and my intention is not to criticize the Rebbe, because I don't know necessarily if this really reflects his own views, because I know very well how people with the proper ideas, that people get up and say one thing and other people repeat it, and it comes out totally distorted. I mean, it happens with RHA, it happens with myself, it happens many, you know, all the time. So I don't want anybody to conceive this as a personal effect. It has nothing to do. For all I know, it's hard for me to believe that this is what he said. I'm interested in the content of the, you know, we should judge something in any case. In Judaism, we study a person's idea. We don't accept something because a certain person said it. No matter who he is, no matter what his name is. So, people will read this, and they can be influenced by this, and I think it's something that we have to deal with. Now, I don't have to read the entire thing, because they're talking about the issue of what's known as Erla, the fruit of the first 2 years from a tree, and how to eat it. And the fourth year, we can only use in Jerusalem. And the fifth year, there's some of that involved in that issue. And to explain that, they go off into a story. So I'm just going to concern myself with the story. I'll read it to you, and I want to hear your reaction to this. What do you think of such ideas? Okay? Before the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidus, became renowned, it was his custom to wander from town to town and village to village, because one of his approaches to divine service was to inquire among Jews after their welfare and elicit responses of praise to God for their well-being. He was most gratified to hear the loving phrases with which they responded to his queries. Blessed be his name. Praise the Lord. The loving God does not forsake. And so on. It once happened that the Baal Shem Tov visited a certain town where there lived an aged and eminent scholar who for the past 50 years had been piously abstemious, studying Torah day and night in holy isolation. He would sit garbed in his palace and stones until the very late afternoon and fast until after the evening prayer. He would then break his fast with a crust of bread and some water. The Baal Shem Tov once entered this scholar's seclusion chamber, which was in a corner of the synagogue, inquired after his health, and asked him whether his needs were being met. The recluse ignored him. After the Baal Shem Tov repeated his questions a number of times, the scholar became angry and showed his visitor the door. Said the Baal Shem Tov to the scholar, "Rebbe, why don't you provide God with his sustenance? You will starve him, God forbid, and he will depart from the world." Hearing these words, the scholar was perplexed. A Jew, a villager, speaking such strange words about seeing to God's needs so that he should not starve? The Baal Shem Tov noticed the scholar's bewilderment and explained himself. Jews exist by virtue of God's sustenance, but what sustains him? This is answered by King David in Tehillim, wherein he says, "And you, Holy One, are enthroned upon, i.e., you are sustained by, the praises of Israel. By the words of praise that Jews give you for their health and sustenance." Then it goes off into the other thing. Now, of course, it's a distortion of the idea of tefillah. But that in itself wouldn't be the worst thing. People make mistakes. This is out and out kafira. This is out and out kafira. In other words, this is very, very dangerous. If anybody were to believe this, then they would be in danger of being in violation of the belief in the Yud Gimli Khan, the 13th. This is a principal article of Amunah over here. See, there's different kinds of mistakes that a person can make. There's different kinds of mistakes. The Rambam talks about this. That depending upon the subject matter, there's no individual that they never make a mistake. That all of his ideas about any subject are true. So if a person has a mistake, well, it all depends on how significant the area is. The more significant the area, the worse the mistake. The less, if the mistake relates to something which is not that significant, so it's not so terrible that he has, even though falsity is bad in its own right. But when a person makes a mistake about the essentials of our emunah, so then that could mean the destruction of his soul. See, in other words, a person that does not believe in the 13 principles of emunah, as the Rambam has outlined them, he has no share in the world to come, which means he's completely lacking in his status, in his sanctity of being a Jew. Now, I'm not practically speaking what to do about it, but something else. Because I know these things are distributed in the pizza shop, for one. I don't know if they're at all. I've noticed them there. And I was just saying that maybe we should tell the Vav, because the Hefshah on the Kashrus about this kind of thing. Because, you know, they're very concerned about whether something is kosher or not kosher, which is important, but this is worse. In other words, to eat something, let's assume accidentally somebody ate something which was not kosher. That is not as harmful as imbibed in this. This will destroy you completely. Now, let me just give my analysis. I think it's very significant. It's very significant. It maybe when you're saying sophisticated people would not accept this, but what about unsophisticated people? What about their children? There's many people, and there's many adults, by the way, okay, that will accept it. But on a deeper level, I think that there are many people who subscribe on a different level to the same type of an idea, but in a more sophisticated kind of a form. So it's very important in general to be clear as to the basic principles of Amunah. So I want to see the reason what leads people into this kind of thinking. Of course, it's emotionally satisfying kind of thinking. But what leads people into it is the question. Some people raise the question, and they could be misled by the question. You know what I'm getting at? Because he said, well, who sustains God? Now, stated in a different form, people do have this question as to who sustains God, or who created God, right? The question is usually asked in a different form. That is, everything that we see is created, so who created God? Who made God? Now, children ask that question. But adults may not ask the question, but it can be bothering them. Now, the first thing that I want to make clear, this is out and out fear. Even to state something in this way, and there's no justification, because some people say, well, really, they mean something else. I don't accept it. You can't have any kind of a justification for that, because the way it's stated is extremely misleading, and people are stated that way for a certain reason. If you don't mean this, you really mean something else, and you're dealing with something which is very, very dangerous. So then you can't even say things in a way that can give a false impression. But they're stated very openly. Why don't you provide God with his sustenance? How can you make a statement like that? There's no such thing. In other words, the foundation of foundations in terms of our emunah is that we can't do anything for God. One second. I don't know. Let's just deal with it. Before, I don't know what they meant. I'm just telling you what I'm reading. I am telling you, well, I'll take that up afterwards. One step by step. The basic idea over here, the Rambam speaks by the Maran Rukum. We say it in the Tfilah of Ne'ilah. Among other places, it's a foundation of foundations that no matter how perfected we are, no matter how observant we are, We cannot do anything for God. He said that in the Mitzvah, and if you will be righteous, Matzifala, what do we do for you? We're not doing anything for you. Now, there's a very powerful emotion that people have that, so to speak, that if we don't do good, we're sort of letting God down. Or, and if we are, then we're doing something for God. We're sort of making God happy. That type of thing. Now, the foundation, what you have to understand is that anything that we do in terms of yadus is only benefits one party, ourselves. And God gave us the Torah not because God was in need of anything, in need of our worship. It's easy when you start projecting, because the Torah commands us to praise God and praise God. Now, we project in our context, we know that whenever somebody demands respect, demands obedience, demands praise, it's because they have a certain need for that. And when they get it, they're happy. As soon as you have that idea, you have to realize that the person in question has need. Now, that's appropriate, because all human beings do have needs. And no human being is self-sufficient, has needs from the outside world, has needs for other people's respect, and so forth. But the moment you take this and you apply it to God, that's true. It's idolatry. That's a complete distortion. It's the worst form of idolatry, because it's a complete distortion of the nature of God. That God is, so to speak, and whenever we speak about God, it's always in terms of so to speak, because we can't even speak about God. But we can't project. That was all that we discussed, the chet ha'ego. They believed, you know, when they understand that when they made the golden calf, it's not that they believed that this golden calf was God. They still retained the true idea of God, but they wanted to relate to God through a physical thing, which meant to say that they were already in the area of projecting their own emotions. They wanted something that could satisfy their emotions. And God is completely unknowable. Now, the idea that people have that if you follow the commandments, so then you make God happy and God will be nice to you. If you disobey, then you get God angry with you. Or if you pray to God, so then you're praising God, and therefore God's going to be happy. All of these things are false, are total shekher. And if a person has this, then he has within himself ideas of tefillah. Okay, and this can't be repeated, too many times. Yes, the fact that it's egocentric, Jack is making a good point. It's egocentric too, because that's a corruption. Because a person wants to feel that he's extremely important, that two-sided street, that his. And that is true. It is based on an overestimation of our place in the universe. That we somehow do something for God. I don't even want to use the word sustain. It's like a terrible thing to say. But that is not, you see, that problem, that a person suffers from egotism, he has a false notion of his own place in the scheme of things, that would make him feel comfortable. That's a problem we all have to work. Everybody is egotistical by nature, and everybody has to work on their own egotism. And, If a person acts in such a way that he's egotistical and he thinks too highly of himself, that doesn't mean he's not as much here in the world to come. That's a bad character trait, and of course it's gonna hurt. This is what, I'm not even focusing on that. I don't want to really focus on that, because that's 100% true what you're saying. But if that were the case, if that's all that was, I noticed something in an article that shows. It's based on an idea, a false idea, which is based upon man's desire to be egotistical. I want to divert your attention. So it's wrong. The reason why I'm mentioning this is because it is dangerous. I'm going to try and show you why distributing this kind of thing, in my opinion, is the worst kind you could possibly do. Now, I just want to, before we go any further, listen to the language, too. Because you have to be very, very careful with language. Why don't you provide God with his sustenance? The very use of such a term implies that it's a very graphic kind of term, that God has a sustenance. You will starve him. Starvation, you will starve God. You mean to say that they're trying to convey an idea and they're using this kind of terminology? You will starve him? And he will depart from the world? Now, as far as the fundamental of Amunah, which this relates to. It's the Rambam brings this down in Hilchos Yisrael HaTorah. This is something which every Jew has to know, by the way. What are the Ikar? Every Jew has to know for their own perfection. I'll tell you something else. We'll have a question and discussion after. I just want to get my point out. You see, another thing over here, you have to realize when you're talking about a movement, you know, there's criticisms of this movement, of that movement, let's say criticisms of Lubavitch. Now, sometimes no movement is perfect, and no one's going to agree with everything about a different movement, but the fact is that I can disagree with an organization or a movement, and I can still accept them, because nobody's perfect, we have disagreements. Because they say they still do a lot of good and so forth. Now, again, I'm not saying that this is authentic, that this is really their ideas. I'm only saying if this were the case, if this were true, if this were their ideas, and it was authentic, it wasn't somebody's misinterpretation, then you could no longer bring in the argument, but look at all the good that they did. See, you have to understand. When a person is making a mistake in one area, about ego, about this, about that, so there can be other areas where he's clear. Some areas he's destroyed it. Exactly. But when you're making a mistake on the basic principles, then it's impossible. Then they're going to be wrong in every area. And you can't really say that they're doing any good. You can't really use, because what it is, you say, well, they're bringing Jews closer to Torah. But if their idea of Torah is false, and whatever, anyone who has these ideas, you can't say that it's just a mistake in one area, because this is the foundation. And a mistake in this area will color his ideas in every area. See, when a person's foundation is basically idolatrous, then that's it. Then the whole thing is puzzled. Now, the Rambam says in Hilchos Yisrodei HaTorah, he says like this, Yisrodei Yisrodos, the foundation of foundations, Va'amod HaChachmos, and the pillar of all wisdom, Leda Sheyesham Motri Risham, is to know that there is a first being. God. The whom Mamsi Kol Nimsa, and he brings into existence everything which exists. V'chol ha'nimtzayim mishamayim v'aretz, and everything which exists between heaven and earth, u'masha b'neim, and in between, lo nimtzu, do not exist, ela me'amitas m'matzal, except because of the truth of his existence. V'in yala adash, and if you could imagine, shehu einu matzal, let's say we could imagine, because obviously it's an impossibility, but let's assume we could imagine that God did not exist, ein devaracha yachali matzah, then nothing else could exist. Then nothing would exist. If God did not exist, then nothing would exist. V'myala v'adat, she'en chavadam tzah mu'vado mu'tsuyim, but if you can imagine that everything else which existed would cease to exist, hu levado yemot, he alone would exist. V'lo yevatel hu levitula, and he would not be negated, due to the negation of everything else. Why? Shekohan and Soyim Tzarich and Lov. Because everything that exists require him. For who Baruch Hu, but he blessed be he, Eino Tzarich Lahem. Does not need them, V'lo La'achad Meinem. Any one of them. L'fichach Eim Amitaso, Kamitas Echad Meinem. Therefore his truth is different than the truth of everything else. This is the foundation of foundation, that we have to recognize that behind everything there exists a being who exists, but whose existence is different than ours. And I'll deal with the question in a minute, but you see a clear-cut statement, that is to say that God's existence is completely, so to speak, self-sufficient. Because even that thing, any time we use about God, is insufficient, so we have to use words. Because we get a certain idea. God does not depend upon the existence of anything else. And therefore, if God created the world and everything that's in it, everything else that exists can exist only because of God. We have what we refer to as contingent existence, or whatever philosophical term you want to use. We have no basis for our own existence. Our whole existence is dependent. It's a dependent existence. But God's existence is totally different. It's not dependent on anything. And therefore, if God created other beings and they have existence, it is not because there was any deficiency in God. And it is not because the existence of any of these things in any way could supply God with something that he may need. And that's true for the existence of any other being, and that is also true for our worship of God, our prayer of God, and so on and so forth. And the fact that we read in the Torah that God did so much for us and took us out of Egypt and implored us and keeps imploring us and sends prophets to us to follow the Torah and do his commands and so on and so forth is not because in any way God needs this. And it's a complete distortion if we believe in following the mitzvot, and no matter how, being totally perfected, we are doing, and in fact, we say that that's the whole purpose of Yemos HaMashiach, to sanctify, to enthrone God. That's what the Pasuk is very right. You're right, well, he's right, that that's total distortion, by the way. The Pasuk, that's not what the Pasuk is saying. The Pasuk says that they're enthroned, that God is enthroned by our praises. Enthroned doesn't mean sustained. What kind of a jump is that? Enthroned means that God is reckoned, glorified. Right, that's the Yisgar, all the Yisgar, that God's name should be magnified, should be glorified, and known, and sanctified throughout the world. And the fact is that Kiddush Hashem, to sanctify God's name in the world, is the greatest thing you can do. And on the contrary, Chil Hashem, to defame in any way, you know, God's name by doing the bad things is the worst avera. It's not because God somehow needs this, that God needs to be glorified, and when God's name will be glorified throughout the entire world, sanctified, then God will be happy. And until that time, there's some kind of lack. That's absolutely absurd. This is all done for our sake, for the sake of the beings that he has created. This is for us, because God created us for a purpose, and our purpose lies in fulfilling our divine nature, which is to be involved in recognition of God, and in the appreciation of the Chachma of God. And when all of society will come to that level and will be living the correct life based upon a true recognition of God, that will be the sanctification of God's name. That will be for our benefit. It's not that God will not be any better off in any way, shape, or form. I mean, you have to realize, you have to, on a certain level, people have that feeling. There's a certain feeling that we're doing for God. Not if you mean it in this way. Because, you know, sometimes we do use these types of terms. You have to be, of course, you have to enter the Torah. The Torah says, and it'll be that just when God, in the Torah, when God threatens us, right? That God will rejoice over you when you suffer, just in the same way that God rejoiced over you in the Torah. When it says that God will rejoice in us, it doesn't mean what we think it is, that God will be emotionally happy because we're doing his will. It means it's a very strong expression that our, even though we can't understand how it is, that our acting in the correct way is something which is in line with God's will. It doesn't mean that God rejoices. If you really believe that you're making God happy in that kind of a sense, then you're in the arena of fear. It's very, very important to uproot these ideas, not just on the overt level. See, on the overt level, everybody, wow, he doesn't mean it literally. That's another thing. Because somebody wants, I'll get to this, everybody will have their chance. I'll get to you in a second. That somebody was saying, well, no, they don't mean that God will depart from the world. It means that God won't relate to us, that kind of thing, to defend them. I said, that's absolutely, maybe, I'm sure, if you had somebody, well, somebody obviously must believe it. Someone, the one who wrote it, whether it's, as I said, whether that's what was said by the Rebbe, which I doubt, or whether it's a discussion, whatever the case is, there is somebody that's going to have to stand by this, somebody that put this together. That person, if questioned, would probably say, well, I don't mean it that way. See, that you can't, that's total dishonesty. That's false. Because this is what they really mean. You can't speak this kind of, when you're speaking this kind of language, you're trying to evoke a certain emotion. If you mean something else, then why put it this way? In other words, my reading of this is not a misreading. I'm not misreading it. You see? I'm not misreading it. I'm reading what you're saying. This is what you're saying. Excuse me. Now, if you want to say, well, no, no, no. You're misreading it. We don't really mean it the way you're putting it. What do you mean? Then why put it this way? The reason why they're putting it this way is because they're catering to a certain emotion. So be honest. That's exactly what you're doing. You're trying to evoke in people a certain feeling that if they do not pray to God, if they don't praise God, so then they're not sustaining God. And then if they do so, they are sustaining God. And you're, not in the philosophical sense, in a sense, in a really graphic or materialistic kind of a sense. That's exactly what they're saying. There's no hiding behind. You can't hide behind that. All right? So let me just pause for a second. I just want to take some questions. Dibbatar Veloshin B'nai Adam. God knows that there's a basic problem over here, and that is that when you study the Torah properly and you analyze it, you'll see, as we've seen many times, that these stories are very, very profound ideas, and whatever we get, we know it's just a fraction of what there is, divine wisdom. So the essence of the Torah is really profound ideas, divine wisdom, and all the mitzvahs, when you understand the reasons behind the mitzvahs and so forth, you'll see the profound ideas. So if that's the case, so why didn't God give it over in a form which is profound ideas? We've discussed this many times. And that is, I'm sorry? Yeah, because there are very few people in the world in any given time that are really interested in ideas and philosophy. So God established a system. That's the whole uniqueness of the Torah. That is to say that God took a system of abstract, correct, philosophical ideas and transformed it into a religious system which caters to the imagination and the religious needs and so forth of the people in order to get them involved. It's because it's God's will that all people should be involved in Torah, and it's a system where people at whatever their level is. There's no such thing like this in the world, because other philosophers had, you know, a system of philosophy, maybe could transmit it to a few people at any time, and there's no one that's been able to establish a philosophical system and transmit it down the line. It's impossible. Yeah, well, that's why. First of all, in order to have people involved, the Torah has to be written in a certain way, and it has to emphasize certain points in a certain dramatic way, and it has to utilize these so-called anthropomorphic expressions. It has to do so. Now, divine wisdom knows, you know, whether a book can be written, you know, your way, whether the expression can be done this way, or whether it can't be done that this way, it just won't last. So we needed a Torah Shabbat, which incorporates the story from creation and the Yard of Oz and so on and so forth. And when it comes to certain parts, to convey the idea that this thing is extremely bad, it does say that God's anger will kindle against you. It does use expressions that, if misunderstood, would indicate that. Now, the point is, In order to prevent falsehood and corruption, that's why the Torah was given with a system of Torah Shabbat. And that's why if you remove Torah Shabbat, like the Reform and Conservatives, they remove the oral law, so then you're right. Then you're left with a situation where a person can read the Torah any way he wants. He can come to any conclusion. He can come to the conclusion. I don't understand how they can maintain that the oral law is not divine. It's a contradiction in terms. To maintain that the written law is divine and the oral law is not is a completely absurd position. Because you must say that when God gave the Torah, he wanted us to fulfill his will through the Torah. And you will also agree that if you remove the oral interpretation, so then there's no way to know what God's will is from the written itself. You can't prove. Where does it say anything on Shabbos? What constitutes? There's 39 forms of work on Shabbos. There's no indication whatsoever. How are you supposed to know? Or how are you supposed to know from the description of tefillin? And you shall bind them as a sign on your hands and on your forehead. How are you supposed to know that it's talking about these which parashiyos that it has to be in boxes? There's nothing. That's why you see all the religions of the world, all the religions, the major ones, are based upon acceptance of what they call the Old Testament, but they all have a million different positions. They all try. There's no way. The truth of the matter is that without the Masorah, without the oral law, there is no way that you can prove what God really meant. So then you're going to say that if God, if you hold, if you deny that the Torah is divine, see, that's the reputation. The reputation of Reform is that they deny that the written law, Torah Shabbos is divine, right? Because that's the case, why keep anything? Just make up your own system. That's what they say, because as we change, we develop, and we've improved, and we're sophisticated. So fine, if that's your belief. But so then you get rid of the whole thing. Why keep anything? What's the point of keeping anything then? Because it's not divine. And it's not divine. It's made by people of the time. So I should be bound by a system of ethics and morality that was made by people 3,500 years ago. It's kind of crazy. So get rid of the whole thing. And the conservative, assuming, I don't know exactly, there's a lot of different branches, but let's say the basic position is that they maintain that the written law is divine, they don't accept the oral interpretation, they're involved in a total contradiction. Because then you're saying that God gave us the written law to guide our lives, but he had no way of seeing to it that we know exactly what he meant. Because he gave it in such a way that you can't decipher the true meaning from the text itself. Moreover, according to them, I don't think they would go so far as to say that those parts that we're talking about, which describe God's mighty hand and so forth, and God's anger, God being physical, I don't think anyone would say that they believe that God is physical. They're not going to say that. They're going to say that's not to be taken literally, right? So how do you know that? How do you know that that's the proper interpretation? How do you know? And once you're removing the divinity of the oral law, then everything is... you can interpret it any way you want. So, the safeguard is the fact that the proper observance of Torah is in line with the Masorah. And once that's the case, we know that these things are not meant to be taken literally. Just like we know that ayin tachas ayin, an eye for an eye. Is not meant to refer to actually corporal punishment, to remove an eye, but mammon, it's money. That's the oral law. The same thing is true over here. So, essentially, when a person is a child, there is no way. There is no way that he can understand this philosophically. There is no way. So you're conveying to the child the idea that that God, so to speak, cared for us and wanted, because God wanted us not to be enslaved, to follow His Torah, and God took action against those people who were wicked and slew them and so on and so forth. And you avoid the best that you can. You avoid giving. There's no way that the child. Of course, the child is going to relate to it on an emotional level, of a being out there who protects us and stuff. You can't speak philosophically to a child, but the child, as he matures, if you just follow the guidelines of the Torah about God and God created us and so on, so the child has an idea of God, a normal idea of God, and as the child matures, he sees what the effect the child is. As the child matures and develops, when he's old enough, then you begin to explain more and more. There should be no problem whatsoever. You divest him, unless you have a problem when you say one thing and the child senses another thing. If the child sees that you're engaged in all kinds of practices, like superstitious kind of practices, you know. When you're telling the child there's no other being in the world but God, and we pray only to God alone, and then the child sees you like knock on wood and do other kinds of things, superstitious, so then that's a problem. Then you're conveying, you see, on an emotional level, you're undermining the ideas that you're trying to imbue. But there should not be a problem. You have specific cases, of course specific issues always arise in chinuch. Well, it's always the case when a child... I mean, I remember having this problem when my children were growing up, because they would have questions that they asked were sometimes, to answer them, you'd have to give something abstract. In other words, very often that the questions are beyond the scope of understanding. You know, they're smart enough to sense the question, and there is an answer, but the answer, they're not ready to hear the answer yet. So their strategy you have to use. I'm not... Look, the thing is like this. There's no simplistic method. We're getting off into something else here. We're getting a little bit off the subject. That's a good issue. That's a good... It's not bad, by the way. It's not bad to have some kind of a forum for that, for these types of questions. They come up all the time. I don't want to devote this session to dealing with education. The point I'm trying to make is that this story should not be told to anyone, child or adult. It is absolute falsehood. The only one that has the right to be metaphorical is the Torah. And Chazal, when they put down the ideas, they put it down in a metaphorical way. And basically, we're not on that level. We talk, when you talk in front of an audience, the audience assumes, I could if I want, there wouldn't be anything wrong. If I took some ideas, I said, I'm going to try and put these ideas in a metaphorical, then you try and work it out, that kind of thing, as an exercise. But if I'm talking in front of a group, and the group assumes that I'm talking straight, what doesn't matter? This type of thing. See, here's an example from this. You can learn what not to tell your child. The important thing is you stick to the Torah. Of course, as a child gets ready, even that you got to be careful what the child is ready for. But this type of thing would be harmful to tell a child, because that is a very graphic statement that God has needs, and your activities, your prayers somehow magically are affecting God. See, that's an idolatrous type of thing. Now, people, on many levels, people are affected by this, even not on an overt level. For example, I was telling my students, let's say, would this be appropriate? Or would it be problematical? Let's say a person were to observe a Christian praying. Let's say, for example, a person is in a hospital, and your roommate happens to be a Christian, religious. And he gets up in the morning, and he prays, and you see he's really intense and concentrating and so on and so forth. Now, you know for a fact that even amongst very religious people, Orthodox people, it's a tough area, Kavanah. They're always, everybody admits that their mind wanders, you down a few times a day, and it's a tough. That's not an easy thing to achieve, a proper Kavanah in Davin. All right? Let's say the person were to say, I really admire his, I know it's wrong, it's the wrong religion, but I really admire his Kavanah, the fact that he has such, I wish I could have that type of an intensity. That's the reaction. Would that be appropriate? Even if I know it's wrong, of course, it's false religion, but I really admire the level of concentration. I don't have that type of concentration. Right on the head. He's not involved. Dave, if you think there's any connection whatsoever between what he is doing and between Alex Fila, then you've got a serious mistake. He's involved in his fantasy, in relating the relationship to idolatry. It means to say, that's not prayer. It's a totally different kind of a thing. It's very akin, I was just thinking, it's basically a person that's projected something, right, based on some certain fantasies. He imagines there are certain beings out there, and if he only wishes hard enough, then he'll get what he wants. That's basically what it is. It's very similar to the thing about blowing out blood at the corner and make a wish. It just occurred to me, it just occurred to me that it's not a good thing to do for children. It seems to me that there is, and I'm not criticizing, because I'm sure no one ever thought of it in this life. I never thought of it in this life. But to me, I see a direct line, causally, between doing that. That is really the whole root of idolatry. Because what's the idea with that? What are you telling a kid? You're telling a kid, now this is a very powerful, primitive idea that we have. It's a primitive idea, which is based upon a false idea of our place in the universe. It's an egotistical thing, that we're the center of the universe, and the whole thing exists for my needs. Okay, well, we all have that. We have to grow. We have to become mature. But it's rooted in the idea of, that's my birthday, it's rooted in the idea of the power of wishes. That a person feels, if I just, my wishing for it, magical thing, strongly enough, will influence the beings out there. You see? One second, there is this, please, let me explain. There is this concept, if you break it down psychologically, there is this concept that there is some connection between the strength of your wish and what's going to happen. Now, that's not tefillah, that's not prayer. If we carry that idea, that's basically what idolatry is. That because I'm going to influence that being out there who is going to satisfy my needs because these are my wishes. It's based upon the power of one's wishes. That's not the idea of tefillah. That's not the true idea of prayer. Of course, we hope there is the idea in prayer that if a person prays, it's possible that God will. That God will respond. Right, but the essence of our prayer is, the benefit of the prayer is not that God will give us what we're asking for, necessarily, but rather that we have the opportunity to, so to speak, communicate, to raise ourselves to a higher level in terms of appreciating the true idea of God, and that we can relate to God in whatever way is possible. So there's nothing in common whatsoever. Exactly. There is bakasha. That is the fact which motivates us to turn to God. That's good too, that we turn to God because we recognize that God is the source of everything, and the only being that can satisfy our needs is God. But the purpose of turning to God is not to get that particular thing, it's rather to experience the benefit of being in line with God, of relating to God. All that stuff is totally false. All that stuff, by the way, is absolutely absurd. You see how that too suffers from this idea of projecting human qualities. This idea of writing a note and leaving it in the kotel is completely absurd. It's very disgraceful. It doesn't mean it's... Now, I don't mean to criticize anybody that did it. I don't want to get involved in anything. Whatever. We can back them now. The problem with that is, it's a denial of tefillah. The whole idea of tefillah is that there is one way. You see, once you depart from the halacha and you begin to set up your own system of relating to God, that then you're in a bind. It's a big problem because you're deviating from the Torah. And when you do so, you're basing yourself on your own primitive emotion of how to relate to God, which is basically idolatry. Now, we do believe that we can under certain circumstances pray to God, and that if we are found worthy, God will answer our prayers. But that is through the halakhically mandated activity of prayer, of tefillah. And that's the only thing we can do. And therefore, to assume that I pray, let's say a person has a need. So do you believe in the mitzvah of tefillah or not? So you have a right to daven properly to insert your need. Now, when you put the letter in the kotel, what are you saying? How can this add to anything? You're saying that really you don't believe that the tefillah is sufficiently efficacious, but it will. In other words, like this, God will not answer your prayer that you uttered in tefillah, but he will read the note and he'll respond to that. Now, isn't that tefillah? Isn't it serious? It's very, very, it's a serious, no. It's one that succeeds because it caters to people's emotions, which are it's a denial of God. It's a denial of Torah. It's a denial of Torah. It is a corruption of Torah. You know, whatever you want to say, it's a corruption of Torah. To take Torah, which is God's law, and to, therefore, it's God giving us his wisdom on how we should conduct our lives, to corrupt it in any way, even in a minor way, would be a terrible, terrible thing. Nobody has a right to do that. Why? Why? Why was there idolatry in Jewish history? What? Now, I want to make two more points, though, before anybody leaves. Just quickly. The question, however, that he asked, if everybody is sustained, Jews exist by virtue of God's sustenance, but what sustains him? That question. Now, people ask that question, as we said before, who created the God? Now, the answer to that question is, the question doesn't make any sense. If this question should ever bother you, the question of who created can only be asked of beings who exist, do not partake of necessary existence. It's dependent existence. This table didn't have to exist. It doesn't exist of necessity. It's what we call accidental existence. Its existence is not identical with its essence. So that's the way it's expressed philosophically. So therefore, it had to have a cause. The cause, we always search for a cause because we know that the thing did not, doesn't exist by nature. So of those things which do not exist by nature, they must have a cause. So therefore, regarding everything that we see, that we confront, it didn't have to exist, but it doesn't exist by nature, therefore it must have a cause. But God's existence is identical with his essence, which means to say that God doesn't have accidental existence. God's existence is essential. God exists by nature, therefore God's existence doesn't have a cause. That is the essence of the idea that we have, that God is the only being who exists, who exists without a cause. Therefore you can't say who created. Who created means what's the cause of this existence. But what's the cause of this existence only makes sense about a being which didn't have to exist and requires a cause. We require a cause because our existence is accidental. But now God by nature exists. That's the answer to that question. So therefore the whole idea of who sustains God is totally absurd. The second thing I want to mention, in terms of how we regard this thing, the reason why it got me so worked up, and why I regard this as being the worst evil, in a sense, if I were to ask you, who is the worst criminal in the Jewish system? What is the worst type of criminal? No, of a Jew, of an Avera. What is the worst Avera in terms of how our system would deal with it? Where would you say the system is the harshest? Now, which sin? No. Cause of Mesis, it's called. A Mesis is one who seduces somebody else into idolatry. That person is treated most harshly. I'll tell you why, because this person gets the death penalty. But I'll explain to you why. In the other capital crimes, before, there are certain built-in protections, because even if a person committed a terrible crime, we don't want to execute a person unless we've given every... There's more... Right, the person has to have asra, exactly, which means warned. They have to be warned right before... It's almost impossible, technically speaking. Technicalities are thrown in there. You can only convict on the basis of a majority of two, but you acquit on a majority of one. You can retry if he's found guilty. You can retry if somebody has a strong argument for anything. But you can't retry the other way. If somebody walked out of no double jeopardy, that's from Allah. Says the shaftu in the end that we shall judge the tzilu and say the objective is to judge him in a framework of mercy, if possible within the law to save him. But when it comes to a mesis, the objective is to judge him and to seek every means to destroy him. That's why the issue of entrapment. You know what they have nowadays. In other words, in order. You see this sometimes it's necessary, but it becomes a legal problem. In order to trap someone, to get yourself with a drug, so you have to ensnare, entrap. So the policeman who pretends he's interested in drugs, and he sets it up, and they catch the guy. But then the question is, you really entrapped him, because he wasn't engaged in the crime at the time. That's the question. Now, what does Halakha have to say about this? Is there, as far as entrapment is concerned? The halacha is that with regard to every sin of the Torah, you can't entrap. If you know there's someone who's a machal shabbos, right? So then, if there are two witnesses and you catch him and you warn him, so then you bring him to court. But you can't deliberately set up a situation to have the machal shabbos entrap him, except for the mesis. In other words, if an individual comes to you and tries to seduce you to worship by, what are you supposed to do? And there's no two witnesses; it's just you. So you're supposed to, there's a procedure over here. You're supposed to tell him, I can't talk to you now, whatever the case may be, but I want you to come later on. Arrange a place to meet with him. Like you're interested in. I want you to come back later on and we'll talk about it some more. And in the meantime, you go and get two kosher witnesses. And you place them in hiding. And then when he comes, you ensnare him. You go through the whole procedure until he actually does the deed. And now it's witnessed by two witnesses, and we don't need Esra, and we... Take him to the bezin and you try him and you kill him. The only case, of the only situation where the Torah obliges us to engage in entrapment. Now, why is this person treated more harshly than anybody else? I wanted to say that philosophically, this person is worse than a murderer. The one who's a murderer, and murder is obviously one of the worst crimes you can commit. And even if you talk about anti-Semites that killed millions of Jews, whatever the case may be, terrible as it is, but they didn't utterly destroy them. They destroyed them physically. But their souls live on. And that's a very important part of our emunah, that the essence of a person is the Tzelem Elokim, the divine image, and that he purifies his soul, lives correctly, and when he dies, his soul lives on. So that even though you have no right to interfere with somebody else's physical existence, you can't shorten it in any way, but the whole crime The whole crime, by the way, of killing someone is only because of the Tzara Elokim. If a man was not a Tzara Elokim, it wouldn't be because you're depriving him. What's so terrible that you killed him? We're going to be that person to die anyway. Let's ask ourselves. It may sound crazy because I don't know, killing is horrible, but let's analyze it. Let's say a person, you kill a person who's 70 years old, he would live to 75. Right? Is there a day we're all going to die sometimes? All right, so it's wrong, but is it? No, you mean? So you mean because you took away 5 years of physical existence? So what are you saying? That you're a materialist, a hedonist? Are you saying that the physical existence is the essence of everything? So he had less physical existence. It's not such a terrible thing. A person, let's say he's 80 years old, so he would live to 82. If you took away, the halach is if you take a minute away from a person's life. A minute away from a person's life is a terrible thing. Well, a person only has 5 minutes to live and you kill him, you're a murderer. That because the whole evil of killing someone is because you're taking away his chance to perfect himself, because the whole purpose of this world is a prose dog. And nobody looks at it that way. We're looking at this world, especially in the modern era, is that eternal youth. That this is the essence of everything. And death is the most horrible thing. Not according to the Yahudis, this world is a corridor. It's the arena that God gave us. It's a very short, fleeting kind of a thing. It doesn't make sense. If you can look at it, if you accept that God created us and you're saying this world is everything, so why is it so short? If it's really, God wants us to have the physical enjoyment, it should be longer. The answer is, it's intended to be utilized to perfect the soul. So when you kill someone, the real evil is because you prevented him from his opportunity to perfect the soul. And even 1 minute. Because we know that a person can be kona olamo, a person can acquire the world to come in 1 minute, he could do tshuva. So therefore, at any point that you killed him, you destroyed that opportunity. So the mesis, I would say, is worse than the murderer. Because the murderer just killed the person physically. But if he's lived correctly, the soul lives on. But the mesis destroys the soul. That's the ultimate person. That's got to be worse than a physical killer. So this type of a thing, in my opinion, for people to go around and to pass out these kind of ideas, that is seducing people into kfira, into ideas of idolatrous ideas. That is to say, that totally false conception of what God is and how we relate to God. In my opinion, it's a very serious thing.